Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Jan Buchsenschütz, the co-founder and CMO of Rico, a software and AI business aiming to transform the manufacturing industry by delivering cutting-edge interactive digital twins of production assets. A team of engineers, designers, and inventors of reality simulation software, Rico aims to set new standards in computer vision while creating software that is fun to use and easy to work with. Its technology helps manufacturers to manage their factories and accelerate their digital transformation. And its cutting-edge technology is why it was chosen by Hexagon's Sixth Sense Open Innovation Platform as one of the members of its inaugural startup cohort. Through Sixth Sense, Rico is being provided with the tools to scale and roll out its vision to more companies around the world. Jan, welcome to Changemakers.
Hi, Michael. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, I'm looking forward to this interview. Let's talk about the business. Frame Rico for us in terms of, you know, I've read out the top line, but if you were to sort of sum it up in a nutshell, the value, the mission, the things that you're trying to do with it, what would the pitch be?
Yes, thank you. I think Rico is really this platform that enables you to reliably have automation in the factoring plant environment. So for example, with our customers, we help them really accelerate this industrial 4.0 game, this automatization game that is currently happening in all plants and factories around the world. The big problem is that the change is just so fast. And I can throw around a lot of buzzwords here, but we all know all these trends are happening and people need to catch up. And our tool as a 3D model gives a visual overview of everything that is happening in the factory environment and thus helps people to understand what needs to happen to keep competitive advantage.
And in terms of the end user benefit, in terms of the world that you're helping to build and create, if there's somebody who is just not a tech type of person that's listening to this and wants to think, so what's in it for me? What does the business do that I guess makes it a force for change in the world?
I'd say the major impact that we have is that suddenly there is a transparent view on all factories around the world. Many manufacturers manufacture their goods elsewhere in abroad the sea, for example. While the planning and the engineering is done in, for example, Western Europe or in the US, the production is done in, for example, Southeast Asia. Mm. And for us, it is very important to have this transparency. Now, every engineer can open up their business laptop and see a millimeter accurate 3D model of the factory, its emissions, for example, its impact that has on the local environment by just browsing through the 3D model. Of course, it's a small step and we are not there yet, but it's gonna change the view because suddenly everything you do is locally observed.
And I suppose, does that just mean we're going to make more stuff? Or does it mean we're getting, I mean, I'm thinking about some of the things that you do, the sort of digital twinning, the sort of AI work. I mean, in terms of where this takes us, is this just more, you know, better, faster, cheaper, deeper production, or is there something that feeds to some of the other values in the world in terms of sustainability, in terms of, you know, I suppose the things that we want to do things more mindfully and respectfully?
That is a very good question. What we always try to answer is how difficult it already is to do basic factory automation in our factories around the world. That is a big challenge. And now, if we think about reaching more sustainability goals and reducing emissions, for example, think how much more challenging that is to execute on a factory floor that is 4,000 kilometers away. So what people currently do to help that is they draw PowerPoint slides in 2D and they try to bring over their point of value of sustainability. But with us, they have an entire 3D model. And then it's not anymore about, oh, this is the energy consumption my factory is having today. It's look at these four factories' assets. Look at these four machines. They use more energy and there's more modern equipment out there. Let's exchange them. Let's reduce this energy consumption. And everyone gets it because everyone sees it in a 3D model directly.
I mean, I'm sure you'll know the William Gibson quote from the 90s that the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed yet. I mean, in terms of the influence and impact of your technology, presumably it's going to be more than just the day job of manufacturing. Presumably there are going to be uses elsewhere. There are going to be things that we see in terms of, you know, how things happen. I interviewed somebody from McLaren the other day who was talking about how, you know, Formula One technology finishes up in tomorrow's production car. In terms of the sorts of innovation that you're doing, where will that go in terms of that distributed world that we're looking at?
Yes. So as a company coming from a technical university in Germany, we are all about this artificial artificial intelligence approach to generate those 3D models. So our core technology is an artificial intelligence that can detect objects based on their 3D geometry. And this alone is very powerful. So objects, factory assets that we create, they know, you know, there's a machinery standing or there's a crane standing because our AI has detected the 3D geometry of a crane and said, well, this must be a crane. So fast forward to that, if you think of any other geometric object recognition, might it be in an office space, might it be at your home. And Apple has already pushed towards that with offering LiDAR technology, the technology that is enabling this data gathering of 3D data on iPhones and iPads in this current generation. So if we fast forward to that, we are coming towards a world where we teach essentially computers to understand what is out there in the world by just capturing the data. It's something that has been done with image recognition, for example, but not with 3D so far.
And how excited are you about the metaverse as a frontier for your work?
I think that is something we try to stay away from it a little bit because there's a lot of buzzwordiness around it. And it's all about the value of the metaverse. But in the end, this is a core technology that could enable one of these metaverse theories. I think there is a huge opportunity out there. And with, for example, NVIDIA Omniverse, one of the lead platforms to push towards that direction in the manufacturing space. We see this happening in our industry as well. It's about the value, but I think this 3D scanning technology and the AI that we have developed will be core components in this process.
Well, I mean, you know, you see it in your sales deck and you see it in some of the writing about you. It's not just a kind of, you know, there's almost a Ready Player One type thing to this, isn't there? There's a fun element to this in terms of, I suppose, is it gaming? What's been the sort of the inspiration?
Yeah, the inspiration has been gaming. When we said, let's do factory planning, we said we're going to do it differently than any other factory planning software out there. Because these softwares are usually very large, very slow, very complicated. We said, no, it's about fun. If we want to change the factories of tomorrow, we need to have fun with this. So it's a very easy to use software. I'm imagining coworkers sitting at a table with a laptop or a tablet in their hand, and they're like, oh, let's draw this the other way around. It almost feels a little bit, for me as a young generation, feels like playing Minecraft, but on a factory floor.
So you can have fun at the office as well. Now let's move on to the founder story, because you're one of three co-founders. You were all together at Aachen University. Is that where the dream came? I mean, you all went on to have other careers, I noticed, in terms of where you went. But do you see yourself as a spin out from the innovation program there? Tell us a little bit about that startup story, I guess.
Gladly. Felix and Patrick, my co-founders, they're family. They are the first people I met when I started off studying in Aachen. And I moved 600 kilometers away from Flensburg to Aachen to study there. So they were the people I stayed up day and night to study for exams. And Felix eventually became a roommate. And we always talked about these ideas of doing our own thing, because you're coming out of university and you start working somewhere, but you always ask yourself, what if I would, you know, if I could just do what I think would make an impact, what I think would be adventurous and cool and fun to make, then of course our WTH Aachen University contribute really highly to our success and as a startup, because they always supported us. The core technology has been developed by Felix and Patrick from the tech side. And once we had a point where we said, oh yeah, well, this might be a good opportunity, because Apple published those gathering devices and now everyone was able to capture 3D data. So there was a large opportunity there. We said, let's build an AI for that. Let's make it happen. And we said, we sat down and we built the company. And now a year after that, we are already 14 people with two offices.
How have you found that? Sort of, I suppose, how do innovators find themselves as entrepreneurs?
I think we were a little, some of us worked in the space before, and we were a little annoyed how this 3D data was captured, and everyone was phrasing it and say, oh, it's going to be the next metaverse, it's awesome. But no one was able to use this data, because 3D data processing is quite complicated. So I'd say it was a problem that annoyed us. And we said, oh, let's build something that is helping us solve this problem. And then once we built it, and to be honest, we were very interested in solving the problem, we said, oh, now we can make this available to others to use it. Then we said the impact we could have on manufacturing with that, and we continued.
Well, I mean, I suppose that grit in the oyster of having something that you wanted to solve is part of the pitching story. And of course, you've been very accomplished at pitching it and capturing the attention of other organizations, the latest of which is Sixth Sense. Tell us about the program and actually the process in terms of joining this inaugural cohort.
Yeah, Sixth Sense with Hexagon. Hexagon is one of the largest manufacturers of the hardware that we need to run the AI on and generate these models. So one perspective from us was always, how do we make sure that we always can access this hardware, that our customers can always generate these models? And with the first idea of Hexagon Sixth Sense, when it came up, it's like, yes, that's it. And of course, we were very cautious because it's a corporate, and corporates and startups, the collaboration, it does have its pros and cons, but we were nothing but astonished by the work that Milan and the colleagues have done. The program really offers value beyond what we would have imagined. And that is mostly because the access to the Hexagon employees has been so good. So we talked to a lot of the senior management. We talked about our vision, our problems that we see. They are opportunity to be part of Rico and our opportunity part of Hexagon. And this has just been really valuable in such a short time, next to, of course, meeting all the other awesome founders. Which
now, you've been on four accelerators. Sixth Sense, what makes it different?
Yeah, good question. We've been on four accelerators by now, with UC Berkeley Skydeck being the largest one. But what I really see with Sixth Sense is the engagement of the corporate, and UC Berkeley was a university, so you cannot compare that, but the engagement of the corporate at Sixth Sense was insane. There's a lot of talking, firesides and events, but having people really follow up, oh, did you understand that? Shall we connect? Or do you need help here? Let's have a deep dive, or let's talk about this and this. Having people set meetings in my calendar, telling you, oh, let's chat again, let's go over that. I think we can do value here. That is what has really surprised me, because a lot of these things are on the surface sometimes. And Hexagon, they really dug deep. They really dug deep to make a value for both Hexagon and for the startup, for us. And that's something I really appreciate.
Well, you mentioned Milan, and Milan, of course, is our other guest this week. Been talking a bit about Sixth Sense from a Hexagon perspective, and really the kind of the goal and the opportunity to help the business see around corners, to see the future, to give it that sense of what comes next. What have you learned about yourselves going through a process like this, where you're working with, you know, a global business, a business that is operating on a major scale like that, in terms of, I suppose, the opportunity and learnings that you found about yourselves as operators of businesses, as innovators and entrepreneurs?
Yes, I think what a big learning from our side is that if we want to collaborate with the world outside of our startup sphere, we really need to focus on the relationships that we build with these people, because a lot of these people need the backup and the support of their company to be able to move anything. So even if senior management thinks it's a great idea to do that, if they don't get the backup and the goals and the roadmap to make this happen, they will not get the innovation happen. And for us as young startup founders, of course, we say, oh, we should do this the other way. And next week we have it done the other way, and we have thought about that. But the rest of industry and of the market, it does have some rules to play by, which is, you know, thinking of maintenance, thinking of legacy code. This is something we really learned to we need this relationship, we need this understanding for the big corporate world to be able to be successful.
Right. I mean, you mentioned yourselves as young startup founders, and there are a lot of young startup founders that listen to this show, and, you know, their dream is to go big, go quickly. I guess in terms of the advice that you'd give yourself a year or so in to the business, if you could start again, are there things that you've learned? I mean, how steep has the learning curve been, and what's the advice you'd give yourself if you're starting again?
Yeah, it's one of the advices we often hear, and I'm wondering myself why, when I heard this advice, have I not adapted that? But my advice would be, talk to everybody who is already in this industry, who is a customer, a buyer, a user, who has the problem, and talk to them right now. Most often we build big concepts and how things will work out, but the biggest proof of that is talking to the people who have the problem today. And this has been the biggest value for us, and the learning curve has been so steep because we're working with all those corporates out there who have the problem, but we spent half a year developing something, thinking of us solving a problem, and then we actually build something that's solving the problem after we talk to all the people.
Is it? I mean, I remember I interviewed Martin McCourt, who was the former chief executive of Dyson, and he said that one of the things about working with innovators and engineers is that, of course, they are problem solvers, just as you've just said there. He said, but the issue is, how do you make sure that you're plugging into an issue or a challenge that the market actually wants solved? So in terms of the commercial element of that, making sure that you are on point and that you have a product for progress. I mean, is reconnaissance the way? Is that how you make sure you are attuned to the needs of the market?
I think it needs two sides. One, it needs a very open mind to listen to what people have to say. And then of course, it needs a filter. Is it big enough of an opportunity? Can we do this? Do we have the capabilities to build this? In the end, what we did, what made us grow so fast in the space is we did proof of concepts. We walked up to large corporates like a Siemens and a Volkswagen, and we told them, hey, would you be willing to spend money on this? Just a small amount, see it as a form of trust. And we as founders, I throw myself in there for 2-3 weeks, and I work out what we can work together, what we can build. This has been a great, great contribution, because one way we could do a model for us, and then the other day we could learn from the customers.
And when you have a Siemens or a Volkswagen, a VW, what gets them to yes? Is it that you mentioned a sort of, well, it's not a big spend. I mean, what gets them to say yes where others might have got a no?
I think two factors are important here. One is persistence, because these obviously get contacted a lot by people who want to do business with them. So be persistent and don't take a no for a no, but say like, oh, well, maybe that's another time then. And the second one is direct proof of value. So if I say I have seen this problem in the industry, and someone else says, oh, you won't believe how big of a problem that is in ours, and that is always like, oh, we're talking on the same level. Awesome. So I've seen the solution. It's all about problem solution fit. I've seen the solution out there, which we are building. Do you think you want to give it a shot? I can prove to you in 3 weeks that this is going to be more valuable to us than the money you're spending on us. This is what people need to decide which project they're going to do with startups.
I enjoyed reading your vision statement that digital transformation does not need to be difficult. We just need to include everybody in the digital world of tomorrow. I mean, this issue of digital inclusion, of making sure that we don't have such a thing as digital poverty in you know, what is a human-made product service experience. Tell us a little bit about how your business sees it in terms of this unprecedented digital transformation that our society is living through, and how we make it inclusive enough to live up to a mission statement like that.
Yeah, that is a good point. I think we are accelerating every year with what is coming on the side of the digital revolution. And it's going as fast that even my team sometimes sees, oh, wow, what is going out there? What is new? And we see ourselves in the front of a computer vision AI that is yet not on the market publicly. So there is a lot happening. And I think to include everybody in it, it needs to be less complex. It needs to be easy. And this is what we try to do with Rico on the product, because 3D modeling software and 3D digital twin software has already been out there. One of the challenges is it's mostly experts that use these tools. It's not the everyday factory planner or manager that is willing to do all these classes to be able to use product A or B. It's the guy who has 12 other softwares he gets every year to use, and they are all new and the new cool thing. So it needs to be intuitive. It needs to be easy. It needs to be building a community around this to include everybody. Because if we do not include everybody in the process of, for example, factory planning, then we lose people on the way. Because people will say, I will stay with my Word document or my PowerPoint, but I will not able to use this complex software. So people don't try. I also think that many people do not dare to step because they feel they could not succeed there. If they would use a 3D software for our product, for example, they would fail, and everyone would say like, oh, that's why you should use PowerPoint and nothing else. So we need two things. We need to include everybody by building products that are less complex and more intuitive. And we need to be more brave in the team, in the corporate, say, hey, let's just try it out. If we fail, it's going to be fine.
I was looking at your reading list for the lockdown advice you give, which we published with this episode, and I took from it that you are a very positive person. From the sorts of things that you read about, Steven Pinker is a preferred read, looking at issues about, you know, why violence has declined. I would imagine people like Hans Rosling, the Factfulness author, would be in there in terms of this idea of the improving force. I mean, when you hear a phrase like tech for good, and I suppose business as a force for good, presumably that's the sort of phrase that appeals, is it? And one that you would want to see yourself as part of in terms of a movement for change.
Absolutely. I think it's very important to nowadays not do something because you get money out of it or you get the power out of it. It's about making a change. And I know that I can only hold employees if they have purpose in what they're doing and if they feel connected to the cause of what we are doing. So I would very much agree with the statement.
I mean, a lot of people would look at the same set of facts and, you know, I might feel quite negatively about things at the moment. You know, the Steven Pinker book, for those that haven't read it, looks at, you know, a statement where it says humankind has never been better off than today. We need to believe in the better side of humankind and society. Well, you wouldn't have to try to sort of travel very far to find people that would say, actually, that's not true. And I don't believe it's true because look at, you know, war in the Ukraine, look at, you know, shootings in America, look at a whole range of what fuels the positivity, the outlook, I guess, in terms of, you know, what's the advice you'd give in terms of how you maintain a positive disposition?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally understand how people are scared and how people feel insecure in a world today where there's so much is changing. And while embracing change is sometimes difficult, my advice would be to not only focus on the subjective news that we get and the things that we receive on how bad everything is, but to look for the nuggets, for the bright moments that still happen. For example, never have we been more connected with other people all around the globe. Nowadays, I can have a call with someone in the US via my phone without a delay or without any problems. And this is building bridges. I have a lot of friends who are affected by, for example, the Ukraine crisis. And in the first 8 hours, we all connected. We all like, okay, what can I do to help? What can I do to you? How can we interact with each other? This is something that wasn't there 50 years ago. And I think this is something that gives me hope that on one side, of course, people and things are more and more uncertain. On the other, people are more connected and they can create bigger impact together.
And so I suppose central to that observation is the importance of perspective. And perspective is very much the message, I think, of Meditations, the book by the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, which is a super read. And of course, inspired the Stoics, I guess, in terms of this idea of, you know, we're not going to be around for very long and, you know, make sure you get a perspective on what really matters, I guess, to sort of summarize the great works. Is that a fair summary, Jan?
It is a fair summary. It's also a summary of your time is very limited and the impact you can do is very limited. So you should do what you think will have an impact, what you think will be important, and not look too much on the struggle side of life. It has been a big inspiration for me, the book, especially as the Stoic philosophy, because there's a lot of pressure in a startup life as well. And yours are, so what happens if this and this happens? You're like, so what? What shall happen, right? It's giving you hope that what you can do is only in a certain period of time and in a certain duration, and you should really focus on every day that you have to create something.
And, you know, I suppose it takes you into things where you need to have the courage of your convictions. I mean, I noticed that you've obviously got an interest in climate change. You know, you're watching a lot of Sir David Attenborough's work on your recommended sort of things to watch on the lockdown list. But, I mean, is this one of the areas where you think business can show its quality, our technologists can show their quality, and I suppose can manufacturing show its quality in terms of being a net positive to the world and the use of its resources?
Absolutely. And we need to. Some might even say we have a responsibility to do that, because also manufacturing has been responsible for a lot of pollution in the last decades. So saying now let's become the drivers of that change is only for me it's the only perspective to take as a factory leader today. And luckily more and more factories are picking up the space. In the end, if climate change gets as bad as predicted right now, also manufacturers will suffer, sales will suffer, humanity in itself. So there should be an intrinsic motivation for manufacturers to say, what can I do today to prevent climate change?
And I mean, and of course, you know, there are a lot of people that are saying, well, one of the things we can do today is make less things. I mean, presumably though, you are part of the body of thought that says, well, actually there is a solution waiting to happen here that we can innovate our way through the problem.
Less things is a narrative where we have to ask ourselves who is getting less and who would get less things. And if we look at the Western society, for example, the things we consume, the value and the wealth that we host, and if we look at the other part of the world, we are very, very privileged and very well off. So at some point, if we look at climate change and we have other people in the world looking at our wealth saying, oh, I want that. I see it on TV. I see it on TikTok nowadays. I kind of want that. This desire, it's difficult to tell everybody to buy less if you see what others have. So, of course, we need to produce less things that people do not want or do not need. On the other side, we should closely look at what everybody really desires and really needs and find a solution for that. Because only then people will stop buying stuff. If you want a car or a house because you've never owned one, there are a lot of things that will not be able to stop you if you want that.
But I also suppose the job of the innovator is to make sure that there might be a sustainable answer in actually meeting those ambitions for upward mobility and for a positive future that makes progress. I mean, with that in mind, last question for you, Jan, is that you gave a very intriguing new normal, which I think you have to unpack for us, which was standing in front of a burning fire with only a log and a small water pistol in your hand. Now, my mind was racing. Tell us about the burning fire, the log, and the water pistol.
Absolutely. So the burning fire is, of course, and I think a lot of people can relate nowadays, it's today's business environment, where you always check your mail, where you always get called, where there's so much going on. And if you founded a startup and if you have all this work coming up, then of course it's intimidating. It's a big fire. You on one side, you're really happy about the traction, about the context, about the opportunities. On the other side, and this you want to feed them, right? You want to give the log into the fire, make it bigger, make your vision of what you want to build a reality. On the other side, you only have this small water pistol because you have 24 hours a day. You have a team of people that dream, of course, but they also need to sleep and to eat. And you kind of need to choose what you're firefighting right now. So I think it's a really good metaphor for really having to precisely have a priority on what you want to go first. And it's fun, but it's also, of course, a little dangerous.
I think every entrepreneur would get that, Jan. I think how you firefight with a small water pistol. There you go. That'll be the endearing image of this interview. Thank you very much for joining me. Thank you for sharing the story of Rico, your progress as the inaugural part of the Sixth Sense cohort, and for joining me on Changemakers.
Thank you so much, Michael, for the call.
Changemakers is brought to you by the campaign's firm Seven Hills and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works, and if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating?